Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Abhinay. Now, you guys are very lucky. Few generations get to live through one of the biggest crises in economics. We are now going through. And you know, because I was born in 1940 and spent my time in the good days of 50s and 60s, where there were no economic problems. I remember Robert Solow saying in 1965 that all we need is a large enough computer and all the problems of economics have been now solved. Only computing is required. It all fell apart in another 5 years. Anyway, the generation of the 1930s lived through a very exciting time, the depression, and you know, people with 25% unemployment, and life gets exciting. You have to think. You have to think at the coal face, as it were. What is it that's happening? And to me, it's very important for us to understand what it is that's happening since Lehman Brothers crisis of September 15, 2008. For the UK, it started with the Northern Rock in 1 year earlier in September 2007. But what is true is that something happened in 2007-2008. And one of the longest booms in the history of sort of modern capitalism, certainly of post-war capitalism, a boom lasting from roughly 1992 to 2007, collapsed. And when that boom collapsed, a lot of people thought, we got the tools. We can get out of this, no problem. We understand recessions, we understand business cycles, it's not a problem. And you know, Keynes has given us tools tackling recessions. And since Keynes, we've improved with sort of the new classical economics, and we have better models. We've got the, what do we call the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model, in which, of course, cycles cannot happen and all that. But we know the answer. And therefore, a recession like this ought to be short-lived. And now we are here 5 years later and bumping along the bottom. By we, I mean by and large the Western world. The rest of them are not bumping along the bottom. They're perfectly all right. And one of the questions is, what is this almost a tectonic shift in the global economy? We're still used to calling these economies what I would call the newly prosperous economies emerging economies. I think emerging economies is a slightly patronizing word, because if they are emerging, we are submerging without any doubt. We're submerging fast. Now, a lot of debate is still going on whether we are into the third, triple dip recession or double dip recession. By and large, for 5 years, most economies have been bumping along the bottom. And you know, since you guys are all postgraduate students in a sophisticated university, you understand that in measurement of national income, if somebody says the growth rate is 0.5% or 1%, the standard error is about 3 times that. So it could be anywhere between -2 to +2. I mean, we don't know. What is true is that the Eurozone economies, the UK, the USA, are bumping along the bottom. The bottom is slightly higher for the US than for the Eurozone UK, but it's bumping along the bottom. Now, another very peculiar thing is that in 2009, when we had a G20 meeting in London, some of you were probably too young to remember, but you're probably in school. Anyway, Gordon Brown had this amazing global plan. He always had big global plans. And we're all going to reflate together. And if you go by look at it, apparently Gordon Brown claimed that he had got a $5 trillion package agreed to by everybody. Nothing happened. Now, that $5 trillion package was, however, a classic Keynesian response. there is a global recession. Okay, we're in a global economy, globalized economy. Therefore, individual countries may not be able to deflate by their own because there are leakages, especially import leakages. And therefore, but if they all do it together, then there will be a simultaneous recovery in the developed capitalist countries, the OECD countries, and that will get us out of the recession. A few years down the line, we are still, nobody is reflating. And Paul Krugman writes an article every day as to why not. You know, maybe the Republicans are responsible or whatever it is. But one thing to think about is that if something like 20 countries who are simultaneously in trouble and are simultaneously not reflating, it has to be something more than a lack of political will or partisan politics. There's got to be, at least as economists, it is not that we neglect politics, but we ought to actually try and say, is there a way to understand this particular phenomenon in terms of economics? Now, obviously, some people have said, this is a great, you know, crisis of economics, economics has collapsed, modern economics is useless, it's too mathematical, and all that sort of stuff. I don't believe any of this. I think there are tools within economics available which tell us why what's happening is happening. But those tools are not currently fashionable. I mean, I don't think you need a new economics to understand this. You need some old economics to understand this. Old economics which has now been forgotten. And, you know, forgotten by some people. Some of us remember it. So what I want to take you through is what is it that's going on and why? And there's continual debate going on between two people in Warwick University, Professor Skidelsky and Marcus Miller. Professor Marcus Miller wrote an article not all that long ago in FT. I had a long letter countering them. And Skidelsky and I, we sit in a little room called Bishop's Bar in the House of Lords. It's called Bishop's Bar because it used to be a room where bishops used to change into their costume. And now it's been released for us to have coffee and drinks. And we sit there, you know, next to each other. Nobody joins us because it's too boring for anybody else to to follow. And we argue out, and he said, no, but no, Keynes said in chapter such and such, and why is it not? And I say, you know, for following reason. Anyway, so there is, first of all, a Keynesian answer that we are in this particular situation because somehow governments are too afraid of rating agencies or bond markets, or they rate the problem of debt too highly, and somehow it's a lack of boldness. If only they would get out there and borrow money and spend it, spending that money will set up the multiplier process, and the multiplier process will start the revival. Now, you know, in politics, no politician would voluntarily give up anything that makes them popular. And no doubt, if George Osborne thought at all possible that by borrowing money he could be popular, he would do it. He badly needs it right now. Instead of which, there is this austerity thing. The Eurozone, look at the Eurozone. And then the Eurozone doesn't have Anglo-Saxon disease for respecting the market too much and so on. But even in the Eurozone, what you have is one way or another stagnation. When you are out of here, look at the FT today, and there is a new measurement produced by Cass School of Business, which sort of, you know, summarizes macro data and plots it. And basically, everybody is bumping along the bottom. Now, what I want to suggest is that there is within economics an established way of thinking about it, but it is not the Keynesian way. A Keynesian model, if you think about it, is really a model of flow equilibrium. All Keynesian categories are flows: consumption, investment, savings, government expenditure, exports, imports. These are flows. None of you have to read general theory anymore. But if you did read the general theory, there are very few stock variables in the general theory, in the model. The stock of capital is taken as given. And there's money stock, which is exogenously determined. And so stocks play no part in the original Keynesian model. Subsequently, we have introduced wealth effects and things like that. But by and large, stocks are not at issue. And basically, the Keynesian idea is that there is a flow disequilibrium, which is insufficient effective demand. And that flow disequilibrium can be cured by a flow exogenous increase in public investment, some autonomous public investment. Autonomous because it is not dependent on market conditions. It is very important because one of the things which Keynes did that he said, here's an underemployment equilibrium. The Walrasian answer is, an underemployment situation cannot be in equilibrium. It must be transitory because markets must work. Markets must work for, if there is excess supply of labor, the wage rate must adjust. And the wage rate adjusts, wage rate falls, and you get no involuntary unemployment. And Keynes said, no, but that's not the case, because actually a bargain is not on real wages, bargain is on money wages, and there are problems. And so, and then he said, okay, but what happens to, why is effective demand so low? Why can't we cut interest rates and encourage investment? Then he said, well, an interest rate is not determined in the investment and savings market, it's determined in the money market. So investment depends upon animal spirits and things like that, not very interest elastic. So the why can't interest rate be cut? Well, then you go to the bond market and all that. And the idea is that now and then, due to expectations, the money market can be caught in a liquidity trap. And if the liquidity trap is there, then you cannot lower interest rate below, say what he said, John Bull will not tolerate less than 2%. What was his thing? There are downward limits. And so he closed off the neoclassical escapes, which would automatically restore equilibrium to full employment equilibrium. Now, so therefore, his solution was, if you increase autonomous spending, that is my, the whips in the House of Lords telling me that now it's time to vote. I'll ignore that. The idea was that government can spend money regardless of market conditions. And Keynes was quite a fiscally orthodox person. He said, if you spend the money, then a multiplier process will be such that the spending would be self-liquidating. The whole point, whole important multiplier is that it's if you spend X amount, you'll get X times something so that you can recover through taxation and all that, X amount. And that was the idea. Now, here we have a situation in which there is massive unemployment. There may or may not be excess capacity, or we certainly don't know how much excess capacity there is. But there is a reluctance by governments to spend, to borrow money and spend. And the reason is that we have a situation which we acquired during the boom, in which there is excessive indebtedness of the household and governments. If you just look at, of course, governments borrow in recession, but let's keep that out of it. Say, go up to 2007, 1992 to 2007, when there was a booming economy, there was growth, sustained growth, and so on. During that period, not just the UK government, but the US government, the German government, a lot of them were borrowing at the top of the cycle, which is not a very Keynesian behavior. If that borrowing had been self-liquidating, the debt GDP ratio would not have risen. Because eventually the debt GDP ratio should get back to some equilibrium, because you borrowed money, it stimulated growth, the money comes back to the government, and debt can be retired, and so on. So that one thing is that governments got more into debt. And you know, different governments were at a different level of debt GDP ratio, but they were all higher than what they were 10 years before. But more important than that, households got into a very, very large amount of debt. Now, this is also a very peculiar behavior that with full employment and with real growth, almost capacity level growth, 2.5 to 3%, households were still borrowing. And so we ended up in 2007 with households considerably in debt in prosperous times. The UK ratio was 140%. Household income to household debt to household income, 140%. So you have households in debt and you have government in debt, and then of course recession takes place. And when recession takes place, incomes drop, and both for the government and for the household, and so the government borrows more to meet their requirements and household. Now, this sort of indebtedness situation is not something that we have been used to modeling in our macroeconomic models. It's a very peculiar situation that you have. In a sense, when people were talking about the high level of debt during the boom, I remember saying to somebody, in a sort of standard Keynesian answer, the level of household debt doesn't matter as long as households can service the debt. As long as income flows are robust, households service the debt, who cares about debts, right? But if income flows are not sustained, then you have a problem of rising household debts. In a situation like that, you have what I would call a stock equilibrium, not a flow disequilibrium, a stock disequilibrium. Now, you know, stocks and flows, you all know about stocks and flows. But you know, one of the things currently going on in newspapers, you know, regardless of what George Osborne may say about cutting deficit, the debt is still going up. Of course the debt is going up. The debt will go up until deficit comes to zero. Even when you're reducing the deficit, the debt is going up. That's a stock. Deficit is a flow. Okay? If you want to get the debt down, you not only have to finish deficit at zero, but you're going to start putting surplus on the budget for debt to get down. Our attitude is, forget about the stock of debt. Just let incomes rise, and the debt-income ratio would go down. But that doesn't actually obviate the necessity of paying the debt back. You know, somebody, and the question is, if you are in a situation where your debt-GDP ratio is very high, and people do not believe you can get a growth path which will get the debt GDP ratio down, why should they lend you money? Now, another peculiar thing is that at the original Keynes model, Keynes was haunted by the idea that there would be excess savings in rich economies. He really was worried that if things were allowed to go on like they were, there would be excess savings, and excess savings would make it impossible for full employment to be maintained, because no amount of investment would be available to match it. And interest rate would be prevented from falling too low, so that would be a... And so he very much wanted to drive interest rates to zero. His model was that there is a class called the rentiers who hold the debt. It's a closed economy model. The rentiers hold the debt. And the idea that the government should basically drive the interest rate down. So you have the euthanasia of the rentier. The rentier has to be eliminated as an income-earning class. Through the first few post-war years, governments tried to maintain a very, very low interest rate and for various reasons to be not feasible, but that's another story. Now, our situation is that we have been under-saving. We have not been over-saving. Governments and households have been under-saving. And because government has been under-saving, it is not possible to drive the rentiers away. We have currently a QE, a quantitative easing policy, and the nominal interest rate is very low. real interest is negative, and I want to come to later on whether that's the right way to go about it. But what we do have is that we have a excess indebtedness of the household and governments, under saving. Indeed, in the UK data, household savings turned negative in the last few years of the boom. Quite a lot of the households during the boom were convinced that they didn't need to save, all they had to do is to buy a house. And if they bought a house, the house was a sufficiently good replacement for acquiring any assets. Now, one very peculiar thing about a house is if you buy any other durable, it depreciates very rapidly. We have the entire Western society has convinced itself that houses appreciate in value despite being durable, which can only be for one reason, that we believe that either because of land scarcity or something else, house prices inflate more rapidly than commodity prices. There's no other reason why houses should go up in value. So it obviously is a bet on inflation. House buying is a bet on inflation. And what really happened more spectacularly in US than in the UK is that the society overinvested in housing and house prices collapsed. A lot of wealth was wiped out. Now, so that is the general context in which one of the paths out of this is to deleverage, as it is called. Households have to deleverage, governments have to deleverage. And it's a long path before we can actually get out of this stock disequilibrium. Stock disequilibrium, as I was saying before, take a long time, take much longer to get out of than flow disequilibrium. So that is one context. Now, another question to ask is, if we were under saving, who was lending us the money? You know, how could we get away with borrowing? Like we were borrowing like there's no tomorrow. I mean, my interpretation is that for about 15 years, we all borrowed money and spent it on coffee shops and high streets. You know, there are no more coffee shops than you can believe possible. And I used to wonder idly in the good days, who drinks all this coffee? But people were drinking, and you had latte for £2.50, and people went on having lattes and all that. Anyway, high street shops are going bust like nobody's business, because basically it was a consumption sustained by credit. Now, what is interesting is that it was the emerging economies who were the net savers, especially Asian economies. Asian economies, especially after the Asian crisis of 1998, became very conservative and started accumulating stock of foreign exchange reserves. And so much so that, they couldn't even given the rapid rate of growth, like in China and Indonesia and India, not invest as much savings as they had. The Chinese savings rate is 45 to 50% of total income. Ours was minus 6% at that time, so a little bit of a contrast. And China, India, Indonesia, all those countries were accumulating large amount of foreign exchange reserves, and they had to park them somewhere. So they parked them in US Treasury bills, so in some or other Western market, because these markets are deep, liquid, and you can get a little bit of interest yield on that, but you can pull out anytime you want. So liquidity is the most important thing. Now, what that did to the credit creation in the developed country markets was it made credit very cheap. You should read Alan Greenspan's memoirs, because Alan Greenspan was a great guru, great central banker. And because earlier on, we had lived through a period of inflation in the 70s and 80s, and the monetarists were very, very powerful, and monetarists said, control money supply to control inflation, and we had a lot of debates about that. We finally arrived at a kind of what's called a great moderation that gives central banks the charge of monetary policy and they look after inflation. Now, Alan Greenspan thought, am I not terribly clever? A lot of credit available, interest rates are low, growth is fine, but inflation is low as well. It must be my genius as a central banker. But of course, nothing to do with the genius of a central banker. What was going on was that, and I'll just say the Chinese, generically all the Asian countries, the Chinese were on the one hand lending money to us. We were buying their product because they're also exporting goods to us. And we were running trade, large current account deficits. I gave him money. And then the Chinese gave the money back to us. But along the way, because a lot of our manufacturing industry had collapsed at home and migrated to Asia, the Asian manufacturing was much cheaper than what we could have done. That's partly why. So in the 60s and 70s, when we used to discuss inflation, inflation is mainly because of manufactured goods prices. People used to talk about monopolistic competition and all sorts of things. Suddenly, the supply curve of manufacturing shifted massively to the right. You know, 200 million extra workers entered the manufacturing industry. And in manufacturing goods prices was no longer a cause of inflation. Inflation now comes from mainly primary commodity prices. Primary commodity either going up because of harvest fluctuations or because of speculation. So the Chinese did two things. First of all, they eliminated the threat of inflation from our economy and then lent us money to spend. So we were able to have massive amount of money supply without inflation, which contradicted the basic tenets of monetarism. And all that was going into a consumption-led growth. And that situation collapsed in 2007, 2008. It collapsed actually for a technical reason to do with banking. A particular ways in the banks overextended themselves. Some of the assets in which they had put money became devalorized, and the banks found themselves with liabilities they could not match with the assets, especially short-run assets. You see, what happens in a lot of these situations, your assets in some kind of a net worth may be quite a lot. But if your short-term, somebody asks you to pay off a debt immediately, and in the immediate thing, you don't have access to enough money to be able to meet the debt, you go bankrupt. They don't care about your net worth. They care about, can you pay that? That's what happened to Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers was worth $600 billion on a Friday and worth nothing on a Monday. Think about what it says about economics. How do we value capital? We have all this formula, capital asset price measure. How do we value capital? Certainly $600 billion can disappear over a weekend. Not even a very long weekend. So it makes you think as to how fragile some of these notions are. So one of our problems was that a flow of cheap credit from outside sustained a consumption-led boom for about 15 years. And that collapsed when, first of all, banks got into a very highly indebted situation. Governments had to bail them out, and then it became clear that given that the banks had to be bailed out, credit became very tight. And households realized that they could not sustain their consumption, and we have the current situation. Now, what is interesting about this phenomenon is that this was perfectly well described in the late 19th century by, I think, one of the greatest economists of all times called Wicksell. Wicksell was a Swedish economist, very, very interesting person. He had to go to jail for being insulting to the Swedish royalty, among other things. Now, Wicksell was convinced the Valrasian general equilibrium model was correct, that markets adjusted brilliantly and smoothly, so there could be no underemployment, nothing like that. Equilibrium was always there. But not being stupid, he also noticed that there are cycles, business cycles, as they were called. So he thought, how can we have business cycles in a Walrasian world? So one answer was that there is something missing in the Walrasian model, which may be the reason of the crisis. Was there something? Money. The Walrasian model is entirely free of money. So the idea was that maybe it is money which is the cause of, and at that time, because of development in banking and so on, what had become available despite gold standard, that banks could sort of settle each other's debts. So the net position each bank had to meet in terms of outstanding liability was much smaller than the total amount of credit they could create. Okay? And because you write a check, the sum total of checks, the gross value is much larger than what banks have to claim from each other. So they could save on cash. From a small cash base, you can build a large credit mountain. And basically, the history of financial revolution is that over the decades, we have been able to create bigger and bigger pyramids of credit from smaller and smaller cash base. But eventually, when push comes to shove, you suddenly need cash, and you don't have cash, you go bankrupt. So that's another peculiar paradox of a monetary economy. Now, Wicksell said that banks were by and large conservative. So the rate of interest at which they lent did not change very rapidly. But on the other hand, the profit you could make from borrowed money sometimes could go up or could go down. Now, the profit you could make, the rate of profit you could make, he didn't call it rate of profit because Marx had made the word profit rather dirty. So economists avoided the word profit. He called it the natural rate of interest. The natural rate of interest was the rate of interest at which investment and saving were in equilibrium. The market rate of interest was the rate at which the banks lent money. If the market rate was below the natural rate, then everybody went out there and borrowed money and invested. And especially because a low interest rate makes long-run projects feasible. A low interest would drive people to go into, long maturity investments, especially productive investment, innovations, and so on. Now, if the interest rate kept on being low and profit rate kept on being high, that would be a cumulative upward cycle of borrowing and kind of, And this is because Wicksell didn't quite know why, but either because there's a cash leakage, and in those days, the gold standard, so government could not print money. You had a metallic standard. Gold started flowing out of the country, and you had to. Something happened, and banks panicked and put the interest rate up very sharply, from very low to very high. And a lot of projects were no longer profitable, were no longer feasible. And they had to be abandoned. And you started on a downward cycle because there were abandoned projects, unfinished, people were made unemployed, and so on. Now, today when we do macroeconomics, we say, oh, what is the total capacity of the system? What is the productive capacity of the system? We basically believe that capital is malleable. You know, idle capacity here can be used over there. And it's, but the 19th century view was that capital is specific. And the abandoned capital of those projects could not suddenly be switched around in other activities which could be profitable given the new situation. So you had this abandoned capital, and you had unemployed workers and unemployed capital, and you are in a cumulative downswing. Now, one thing that Keynes did, which was not available then, was there was no belief in active policy. Very few countries even had a central bank. And if you had gold standard, the central bank could not do very much anyway. Most governments believed in balanced budgets, because given gold standard, you could not. I mean, if you want to worry about gold standard, think of the Eurozone. The Eurozone is a contemporary version of the gold standard, because the European Central Bank cannot buy government debt in the primary market. So the European Central Bank cannot print money for any government, like the Bank of England can print money for the UK government. The ECB can only create money if a commercial bank comes and asks for accommodation, giving collateral as some paper, which could be government debt. So the Eurozone has a limited amount of money supply, which can only be endogenously increased. It cannot be exogenously increased. And gold standard was like that. So anyway, the idea was that you had this sudden jerk in interest rate, in market interest rate, and you had. And once you were in that downward swing, nothing much you could do about it. You had to wait until basically, you know, all the excess stuff was worked out of the system, somehow the old capital was destroyed, whatever it was, and expectations changed and people started feeling optimistic about profitability and started borrowing again. Now, Wicksell was a very influential person until Keynes. Keynes wrote one book called Treatise on Money, which is very Wicksellian. But Hayek was another famous economist who was a Wicksellian, who took a Wicksellian view of the cycle. And a third person was a Swedish economist called Gunnar Myrdal, wrote a brilliant book called Monetary Equilibrium. Myrdal and Hayek, politically completely opposite people, shared the Nobel Prize in 1974 for their contribution to monetary theory. Anyway, so Wicksell was very influential in basically thinking of cycles as long cycles, but caused mainly by working of the financial sector interacting with the real economy. And Hayek took on that. I think Hayek sort of enriched the model a little bit. But Hayek's idea was that what had happened was that this low interest and so on had distorted the intertemporal gradient of prices. Roughly speaking, it had distorted the yield curve. And until the yield curve was back to its normal sway, so that you valued long-term decision versus short-term decision properly, the economy would not get back to equilibrium. Now, my proposition is that this is exactly the situation we are in. There's nothing much government can do about this. What they're doing by way of QE is, I think, grossly mistaken, but that's another story. And QE has artificially lowered interest rates. Despite the lower interest rate, nobody's investing. Nobody's borrowing any money. There are always complaints that governments, banks are willing to lend money, but nobody's borrowing money and so on. And there is a mismatch between the few small and medium enterprises which want to borrow money and banks are not giving money, whatever the truth of that. What is true is that despite a very low interest rate, persistently low interest, a negative real interest rate, there is no investment activity in any of the developed countries. And governments cannot or will not raise spending by borrowing. And therefore, in a situation which households are in debt, governments are in debt, and given the financial accounting identity, somebody must be in surplus. Who's in surplus? Corporations are in surplus. Corporates are sitting on massive amount of money, but they're not investing. They're not investing in productivity. They're messing around in the commodity markets and things like that, but they're not investing. And they're not investing because I think that expectations are very downwards, very pessimistic expectations. Now, one of the reasons, and this is sort of my idea and it may not be accepted by you, is that what QE does is it tells people, if I was an investor, it tells me that whatever the interest is like today, they will not stay like this. And I'm waiting for QE to stop so interest rate can back to normal. Like what I was saying about Hayek, you know, let the gradient of prices get back to its normal state. Now, it would be very cruel to say, stop this QE, put up interest rates. One thing it'll do, it will speed up deleveraging. A lot of people who are sitting on negative equity houses will go bankrupt, or they get mortgage foreclosure. A lot of companies called zombie companies, which are also surviving low interest rates, they'll go bust. Now, it's very cruel to say, but unless we get deleveraging speeded up, we are prolonging the agony of the current recession. And the current recession, in my view, is not going to get anything. You're not going to get any growth for about 5 more years. Ignore all signs of recovery. Whatever the stock market may have done yesterday, it doesn't matter. They'll change their minds. So here is the Hayek quick sell model, which is sort of a plausible model. And of course, not much work has been done because the neo-Austrians and neo-Austrians, the Hayekians, don't believe in algebra. They don't believe in modeling. So they kind of, they just talk and talk and talk. I did some modeling, but that was long ago. So we have, and of course, if you actually read Hayek, he's got a very very tortuous theory of capital and the problems caused. But roughly speaking, that is the situation. And that is the kind of way of looking at the world which is not the Keynesian way of looking at the world. And it's also, and I'll stop in a minute, also surprisingly, for the first time in 50 years, or 70 years, we have to accept the idea that governments may not be able to solve an economic problem. That is a very hard thing for us to understand, because that is the promise Keynes made. Keynes made a promise, said, don't worry about economic problems. I have a solution. I can give you the tools to help the government solve an economic problem. And suddenly, as I was saying before, you are the lucky generation who are living at a time when governments cannot solve problems. And so it may be that when you graduate and don't have a job, you'll be able to create the new economics required to carry us forward. Thank you.
So we've got time for about a few questions, probably about 15 minutes. So a few questions in 15 minutes. So who wants to begin?
I think that almost all of the theories you used and you mentioned are hardly taught in any MSc program around the UK in economics. So I wonder what you think about the way economists are trained and educated today at universities.
No, these things were not even being taught when I was teaching. I used to teach a non-examinable course on Marx, Walras, and Keynes. It then became Marx, Wieksell, and Keynes. But nobody knows this stuff. Leon Herfurth is one of the people who writes, and he writes a little bit about it. And then there are a few people, you know, around the corners who have done some work, there is now a Hayek companion in a Cambridge University Press series. And in the Hayek companion, Skidelsky has a long paper on Hayek and Keynes, and I have a long paper on Hayek and Marx, because I think I'm the only living person who sees any parallel between Hayek and Marx. People think I'm bonkers, but that's another story. But you see, because Marx had a theory that capitalism can never be in equilibrium for much long, over any long period of time. The nature of the system is to be in disequilibrium, in a dynamic disequilibrium. And therefore, it'll always have cycles. He did not have an adequate theory of cycles. I mean, he had too many theories of cycles, none of them adequate. But one is a sort of a non-monetary theory, which is quite well specified. But the idea was that it's the nature of economies to have cycles. The idea that economy do not have cycles is an entirely Keynes' legacy to the world. And for about 50 years, almost about 30 years after the Second World War, there are practically no cycles in developed capitalist countries. Then we had stagflation and so on, but we kind of got over it. So we got into the idea that recessions are short-lived. Inflation was a problem, but we controlled inflation by money supply. And so we got into the idea that now, obviously, what happened in the meantime, and what's happening now, is this tectonic shift of the plates, so that the really dynamic capitalism is out there. We have a geriatric capitalism. We're going to bump it. Our demographics have gone completely bad. See, during the baby boom years after the Second World War, not only a demand thrust continually, but people were saving for their pensions. So there was a natural savings rate in the economy built into the system. Now, all those guys have got old and spend their money, and they even spend your money. You know, the baby boom generation has been very irresponsible. Now we've got a static population, but longer living. So the rate of growth is not very high in terms of birth rate, but people live longer. And one of the crises in British economy is how are we going to pay for elderly care? Now, that is a problem of savings. There's a problem of inadequate savings. There's no other problem. You know, regardless of whether the government pays or private pays, nobody has the real money to be able to meet that stuff. So we're kind of cutting corners. But so one way to look at the shift is from the Keynes, the Keynes' theory was right, but there are underlying long-run circumstances, like demographics, which made Keynes possible. Those circumstances are gone now, so it's no longer possible.
Who wants to ask another question?
Yes, thank you very much for the talk. Two related questions. First would be, is your theory that the business cycle is mainly caused by the interaction between financial sector and the real economy, could we model that in a current DSGE model? Or would we have? Do we need entirely new models? And if you have time, maybe also the question, how is your theory of Wicksell related to Minsky's theory of crisis?
The DGSE model is really a Keynesian model. It is more or less a Keynesian model with certain kinds of stochastic behavior. I mean, let me give about 3 minutes excursion on that. So once upon a time, there was the idea that there was a hiatus between microeconomics and macroeconomics. The microeconomics was full employment, valuation. Macroeconomics for Keynes, you know, rigidity and all that. People said, Keynes had no micro foundations. And there are various people saying, and there are post-Keynesians who say, no, Kaletsky, non-comparative behavior. But nobody solved the problem of fitting micro foundations on. And a lot of people also believed that a serious work had done on aggregation from micro to macro. Really difficult problem. And then suddenly everybody abandoned that problem because the neoclassical decided that we'll base the model on a single individual. So micro is macro. Who needs aggregation? So that single individual works, saves, is a capitalist, whatever it is, the government, whatever it is. So in a sense, the DGSE model is quite a thin model. It's a very powerful model. It's a very thin model. It's powerful because it is well-raised. And it's got a bit of stochastic stuff. I mean, I used to be an econometrician. This is not serious stochastic stuff. But anyway, we won't get into that. It would be difficult to build things because basically the Wicksellian theory is nonlinear. It's a nonlinear dynamic theory. And I could write down a couple of equations for you if you want to spend your Easter holiday. I can give you two differential equations in which you can spend your Easter vacation. So I think, okay, from an academic perspective, it'll be great if you could put that into the DGSE. I think it's in Michael Woodford, who has written a book on Wicksell. Oh, the book by a man called Michael Woodford, I think, it's called Money and Interest, yeah. or Interest and Prices. It's exactly the title. I haven't read the book because I'm too old to have to read the books like that. But you should read that. I'm serious because in a sense, he tried, as far as I know, he was trying to integrate Wicksell into modern economics. So that one thing. Now, the second question was about Minsky. You know, I love Minsky, has very great friends with Minsky, but I've never been able to formalize Minsky. You know, and I had students who tried to do it. It is very slippery stuff. And it's not quite, I mean, and there's very lot of good intuition there. And eventually it is a problem of financial institutions getting into a debt asset mismatch, basically based upon optimistic expectations. And when they go wrong, you suddenly have this this kind of panic situation. So the way I would put it is that in an overall Wicksell framework, the details of where the turning point comes and the stuff blows up is Minsky. Wicksell had a very simple banking model. By the time Minsky writes, the banking is more sophisticated. And today it's even more sophisticated than that. But I had a friend and a former student called Peter Scott who tried to formalize Minsky and some article somewhere. Minsky is very difficult to theorize. You read it and you know it's like reading Marshall. You think you always got it and then it slips away from your fingers because it's not quite there. I failed to formalize Minsky. I tried quite a bit. I just couldn't get anywhere.
Any other? There's some more questions. Couple more questions.
There is a gender bias in the questioners.
Yes, that's after you do.
I have. After a while, I'll refuse to answer any more questions from men. Okay.
Thank you, Professor. Yeah. I remember you mentioned an example about China, and I want to ask something more about it. In China,
can you speak up? I'm deaf.
In China, the increasing argument is that the crisis in China is due to the government control too much about the economy. And in the 3 or 4 years ago, they even introduced a 4 trillion RMB project to save the market.
Yeah.
So a lot of criticism is all about the government control. I think it should be a degree. So how can we balance the relationship between the government control and the free market?
How can we relate government control and free market?
Yes, especially in the developing country. You know, developing countries have the bad institute.
It is not government control as such. The question is the government control going with the grain of the market or is it trying to go against the grain of the market? Is it trying to make markets do things which the market doesn't want to do? Or rather say, how can I take advantage of the way a market is going and slightly direct it to where I want to direct it? So in the old days, in the 50s and 60s, developing countries' government had this very anti-market attitude. Stop it, ration it, ban it, sort of thing. And now they're more sophisticated. Now they're realizing that there are ways in which they may have to do something to incentivize people investing or foreign money coming in, or if they are spending their own money, they ought to do it in such a way that it doesn't create a lot of asset bubbles. And one of China's problems is, as you know, only happened day before yesterday, that the property bubble has got out of hand. Now, what's interesting about the Chinese economy, like a lot of other economies, people think, they're a dictatorship. They don't actually run their economy. The control on the economy are very weak. And so a number of times, investment booms in China have been difficult to stop because the regional people do whatever they want to do, and they have banks to give the money, and both the central bank's control on credit creation and government's control on but because it is a developing economy, there are lots more potential there left. It's probably okay if it doesn't grow at 10%, it'll grow at 7.5%. But there is a lot of, but in a sense, there are a number of anomalies in China's economy. For example, at one stage, somebody told me last year, that there are 80 million already built unoccupied houses in China. Now that is a gross waste of capital. I cannot imagine, but there's a lot of capital there. There's so much capital, it's practically zero price. But there are problems, but in a sense, China creates supply ahead of demand, especially infrastructure. India creates supply lag behind demand. So you get a very different, but I think it's not, there's no conflict between government control and market if the control is smart. You need a smart government.
Thank you for a great talk. What I was wondering actually goes more into the model related area. So you said it's a very exciting time to be an economist in. And I was wondering, I always feel like we're focusing a lot on things like business cycles, but not so much on the structural things in economics at the moment. And we're focusing more on the kind of small, but less really fundamental things and not on the really fundamental
like
and big. For example, those DSG models they use to come back to those because we've done so much in the MSc.
Sorry, I'll let Kaldika. Which model?
The DSG models we talked about before.
The QE model?
The DSG.
What? Oh, DGSE model. Oh, wow, yes, yes.
Yeah. Those models, they focus very much.
The Lucas model.
Yeah, kind of. So they focus very much on business cycle things and they ignore like very structural, very fundamental things and ignore things that led up to the crisis. And isn't economics mainly going in this direction, like very focused on the small details and the cycle things you already mentioned, mm-hmm. and not so much structural? And
yeah.
So what should we do as economists to sure. kind of get to that?
Yeah. So the DGSE model is a peculiar thing because their proposition always has been that if a crisis could be foreseen, it will not happen. You know, I mean, this is all of them. And they also believe that there is no crisis, that all observed points are points of equilibrium. Because equilibrium doesn't require a certain level of employment. And all unemployment is voluntary. I mean, this is part of a debate which starts with Ricardo and Malthus in 1815. Ricardo refused to accept that could be anything like disequilibrium in a free market economy. All positions were equilibrium positions. And Malthus kept on saying, no, come on, look around you. And it's very tragic, if you read the debate, Ricardo was so smart that he defeated Malthus despite the fact that Malthus was empirically correct. And to this day, we have that thing. The DGSE is a Ricardian model saying there cannot be such a. And if you talk to people like Patrick Winford, they'll say, of course there is no crisis. You know, there are stochastic shocks. And stochastic shocks shift the economy from one equilibrium to another. And we'll just get another stochastic, either productivity shock or a taste shock, and we'll get back. So the DGSE model is a very powerful instrument which denies that these possibilities can exist. But the DGSE model, although it's called dynamical, it's a linear model. And linear model cannot generate cycles efficiently. I mean, there is a long literature on this, that eventually stochastic shocks have to do a lot of the hard work for producing cycles. The endogenous structure of the model does not produce cycles. Cycles are produced by shocks. And the best that the DGSE model has done, as far as something may have happened revolutionarily different, is they have said, if we simulate a DGSE model under shocks, we can reproduce the typical moments of business cycles as observed. Not predict a particular business cycle, but we can predict the mean and variance in the length of cycles. That was literature when I left it behind. It doesn't say that we can predict turning points. So to some extent, there's a thing. You know, people say economists use too much mathematics. I think economists use too little mathematics. Because linear models will not give you cycles. You know, Slutsky established it in 1937. So if you have nonlinear models, nonlinear differential equation models, you could produce cycles much more efficiently than DGSE models. Now, obviously, it would be difficult to have a nonlinear model which is also stochastic. Very few people have done it. But that would be the real. It's very interesting that theorists who don't have to do modeling have very sophisticated mathematical models, you know, sunspots, equilibria, and all that sort of stuff. But when you come to empirically estimating, it all becomes linear. Linear with lags and, you know, some moving average errors. But there's a man called Ragnar Frisch, who was one of the first who shared the first Nobel Prize, who wrote this lovely article in 1933 about a rocking chair. I don't even know about the rocking chair. The rocking chair model, in a very different cycle, you have a rocking chair. If you disturb it, it will swing up and down. But then it'll stop. But two things. The chair being rocking is an endogenous mechanism to create cycles. But it needs an external shock to generate cycles. What we have not found is a rocking chair which cycles without shocks. Now, some people think that, people like Marx thought, capitalism is a rocking chair which goes on cycling without external shocks. And external shocks make determine timing. But so, but that is a bit, what you raise is a very big problem. And I think if you're going to go down that route, don't go via the DGSE route. Because you will spend a lot of your time and not get anywhere. Okay, I've been there. You I can tell you. I've been there. Done it. Okay. Got the T-shirt.
But we'll take two more questions.
I'm here. I could, I've got nothing else to do.
We need a drink as well.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
But we'll take two more questions. Then we go outside. You can continue.
Sure. Okay. Please. Yeah.
We'll take one question here. One question here.
Yeah.
Yes. What Karl Marx said about the very important inner conflict of capitalism is that wage is in one hand cost of the firm, but in the other hand, the source of demand for the product. So some economists argue that one of the reasons why there happened overborrowing, people financial crisis, is that because wage was limited. So wage was limited below the level of labor productivity growth, and that created, that made working class worse off, so they had to overborrow from the rich people. So some economists say, so the prescription of our current crisis is to increase wage, whatever measure required, so then the overborrowing and some imbalance problem will be remedied. So what do you think about that argument?
Well, you know, the wage story is probably applicable to US data, not to European data. Uh-huh. Now, in the US data, it is true that the median compensation has been flat for a long, long time. And that has been remarked on by many people. That is not true in Europe. And there's a systematic reason for it. It is not that wages below productivity. But what happened was in the 60s and 70s, almost up to the first half of 70s, there was a lot of manufacturing activity in these economies. Now, what manufacturing activity did was if you were unskilled or semi-skilled manual worker, you had a good wage and you had full employment, i.e. you were employed around the year, you know, 40, what in the UK used to be 48 weeks per year, 48 hours a week kind of thing, you know. Now, and you have strong trade unions. So a large part of the lower income distribution was shored up by rising real wages. Now, after the oil shock, a lot of that industry migrated out to Asia. It happened in all, slightly to Germany, slightly less, but by and large, everywhere, the share of manufacturing in total employment fell. Now, what happened in the US, there was no strong welfare state. So the people who previously were in manufacturing had to go into services. Now, the service sector income is a very interesting distribution. If you're educated, you get highly paid. If you're unskilled and uneducated, you get very low paid. You end up in retailing or shelf stacking and things like that. And a lot of the previously manufacturing workers ended up in low-paid service jobs. So the average wage got depressed. It is not that anybody is being paid below productivity, but people were put into low-productivity jobs because there are no high-productivity jobs available for the unskilled. So this is the, now what happened in Europe, a lot of those people are long-term unemployed. Now Europe has maintained a lot of long-term unemployed, low labor force participation rate, because eventually if you're unemployed, you don't have to throw yourself on a low wage job. You got a safety net. So you have very contrasting behavior of wages between US and Europe. Now, question is, how do you raise wages? Well, you know, you can only raise wages by, and only to sustain high wages, by raising productivity. If to some extent there is a gap between wage and productivity, which I doubt, but if there is, you know, there are people in UK right now saying pay the living wage and so on. It has to be some accommodation between profits and wages. You have to get some kind of a, in the old days, with trade unions, very active and to get that. Or you have to have some kind of incentivized tax mechanism whereby employers are encouraged to pay the living wage and get some concession on the corporation tax rate or something like that. You could do it like that. But again, it's not happening. And you should look at the case of France. It's a very interesting case. The French tried to cut working hours in the boom and so on. And they can't now disentangle that problem. And they have a large amount of unemployment. So it's a difficult thing to do. But you know, it may be desirable, but not easy to do. But in the American case, what you would need is better safety nets, which might raise up the wage.
Let's take one final question from the lady over there.
Yeah.
I actually have two parts to my question. One, do you feel that Marxian economics has been sort of deliberately sidelined from what most economists these days are taught? Because most big universities in the US, Stanford, Princeton, Yale, most of them don't teach Marxian economics.
They never did.
And no, if at all, they'd have maybe a token economist, a token Marxian economist. And most times the courses aren't even graded.
Well, you know, briefly, very briefly, in the 60s, you know, they employed one. Or they employed a clean, and the man became Marxist along the way. You know, Steve Marglin was at Harvard, and Don Harris, a friend of mine, was at Stanford. John Gurley, who's the most senior person, became a Maoist halfway through his life, you know. Marxian economics was not taught. I mean, I taught Marxian economics at LSE as a voluntary course and wrote books about it. But it's, you know, people don't teach Keynesian economics, for God's sake. Why should they teach Marxian economics?
But, you know. But would you think that an application of Marxian economics, because it critiques capitalism so much, could actually hold the solution to a crisis rooted in capitalism?
The ground is fertile and open and go and do it. Every generation has to discover its own Marx. You know, we were of the generation of the 1960s when we were luckily, you know, we were doing Marx in economics. I started teaching Marx in economics in following the big student rebellion of 1968. I started doing voluntary courses on Marx in economics. What is it now? 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago, my first book on Marx and economics came out. There's a lot of good stuff in Marx and economics, which is also theorizable. And there is a lot of theorizing in Marx. Again, people have forgotten. But I think, you know, generations have to kind of start their own research into Marx and economics. And there are lots of, around the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of serious work. For example, Michio Morishima, who was a professor at LSE, he wrote a book on Marx and economics, which used modern mathematics and Marx. And John Romer was another person who did. I wrote two books on that. And there were a lot of activity at that time. But it didn't translate on into modeling and things like that, because most people translated Marx into modern terms, but did not take it forward. And actually, I was going to say, the best model of a business cycle is from Marx's work, Capital, Volume 1, Chapter 7, Part 7. And a man called Richard Goodwin, who was at Cambridge, a brilliant man, he summarized the Marx model into a couple of differential equations, nonlinear differential equations, based on a very well-known model in biology called the Volterra-Lotka model of predator-prey. You know the fox and rabbits game? Have you played the fox and rabbits game? It's basically a fox and rabbits game. The game is that you have a Phillips curve. Real wages go up if employment is very high. If real wage rate growth is higher than productivity growth, the share of labor goes up. The share of capital goes down. So profitability goes down. Then investment goes down. So then unemployment increases. As unemployment increases, profitability goes up because the wage share goes down. And you circle round and round. And only two equations, you know, hardly very many parameters. And it is a model which produces cycles which are perpetual, in which there is an equilibrium which is never reached, even asymptotically. And that is the beauty of mathematics. This man was able to do this. It's about a 5-page article. It's a brilliant article. I did a lot of work on that in my life. So, I mean, if you want to go Marx way, go the Marx Goodwin way, and that will give you a lot of insight.
There will be one more question. I've got to say, you know, this man knows too much. It's true, because I know him now. I was a student at the LSE when he was.
You didn't learn any of this from me.
No, but all this stuff you picked exactly. up, the Volterra
okay.
model.
Exactly. He's a theorist. I'm not a theorist. The first article I wrote, which was theoretical, was extending this Volterra-Lotka model. And the only article in my life which was accepted without revision, which then convinced me the theory is very easy stuff. If you write an empirical article, they say, no, do more, add some more observations, add another equation. Theory, it's elegant. Publish it. Okay.
We'll take one
yeah,
lady
sure,
over there.
Yeah, sure.
The lady over here.
Yeah.
And
she's waiting for the mic.
Oh, you want the mic.
She wants the mic. There it is.
So we're going to record it. So this is the final question. Last word.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the talk. In your talk, you referred to mostly macro models as a cause of crisis. And I would like to ask, because I'm studying behavioral economics, and would you say the macro models are the main reason for the crisis, or is it only that you're interested in it so that you're emphasizing them? Or would you think that micro foundations of the macro models would also play some role?
Models don't cause crisis.
Okay.
Models may fail to understand crisis, but
yes.
Models don't cause crisis.
Okay.
Models may only cause crisis if governments take them so seriously that they base their policy on models. Luckily, they're too stupid to do that. I think what it is that our understanding, in a sense, one thing economists do is if a problem is too difficult, they say, pass on to something else. And as I was saying, a right way to do is to have your micro foundation, do serious work on aggregation. Aggregating from individual to macro is very hard work for any moderately nonlinear equations. I mean, for example, let me tell you one thing. There is not a single demand curve published in the literature which has sound microeconomic foundation. Demand curves, you know. And they're not different from utility curves of consumers. Anyway, that was a hard way. The hard way would be to go through aggregation and do the correct linking between them. It'll have to be nonlinear. It'll have to be it had to have stocks and flows. But in economists also like simplicity. You know, we have got this far, you know, and the world still demands us. Because we don't demand a Hadron Collider costing X billion dollars. You know, the physicists say, oh, give us, you know, billions and billions of dollars, we'll collide the stuff, and maybe we will find the Higgs boson or not. What a waste of money. I mean, economists don't say that. You know, the great strength of economics is our data are lousy. You know, we not only don't know what the future will bring, we don't even know the immediate past. You know, we don't even know what happened last year in terms of income. Data crap, they're full of errors, but we have a strong intuition. And our intuition is based on simple models. And then we mathematize them and so on, but eventually even the DGSE is a very simple model. And what we believe is that eventually we'll tweak it a little bit and get over the next crisis, till the next crisis. But economists are unwilling to really do the serious engineering task, going from micro to macro, building this. Partly because we don't do very much teamwork. And partly we think that deductively thinking about a problem will get us farther than any amount of data. I mean, I would say at least while I was active, not a single theory in economics was ever disproved because of data. Nobody ever gave up belief in any theory because it was the hypothesis was rejected. Economists went on thinking. Because in economics, a priori thinking is much more powerful than any amount of data. And it is a very powerful instrument. Economists have been able to, think of the Wallace general equilibrium model. How could a stockbroker sit down and think it out? He's a stockbroker. But he did. And millions of equations and all that, a lot of intuition. And so I think in a sense, it would be good if we went your way. And I did spend a lot of my life being both empirical and trying to do theory. But eventually there is no payoff in that. Someday people will say, okay, we're going to hire 50 economists who simultaneously work on different bits of this model and produce, you know, the Higgs boson of economics. But you know, we're still in demand. People still give us jobs. And you know, there's a lot, I'll end on this. In the 16th century, Britain, there are a lot of astrologers. And astrologers and astronomers were frequently the same people. People didn't distinguish. And people used to go to astrologers to divine their future. And if one astrologer was wrong, they did not reject astrology. They went to another astrologer. And that's what happens in economics. If they don't like one economist, they go to another economist. And so we go on. And long may we go on. That's a very cynical way of putting it, but I think. Good luck to you if you're doing it.